Welcome to Buzz House, a Baker Tilly podcast where you can hear all the buzz around multifamily housing with all the info you need to help you win now and anticipate tomorrow. Hi, I'm Don Bernards, the principal in charge of Baker Tilly's multifamily housing practice.
And I'm Garrick Gibson, a principal at Baker Tilly, also specializing in consulting on multifamily housing transactions across the country.
Let's get started. Today, our guest in the Buzz House is a great advocate and friend of the industry and well-known throughout the industry, Tom Amder, who is with us today from Lincoln Avenue Communities, where his title is Senior Vice President for Policy and Impact. In this role, Tom is responsible for leading Lincoln Avenue Communities' public affairs, state and federal policy advocacy, as well as impact initiatives. We'll be talking with Tom today about housing policy and related matters and what we can expect in 2025. As we are a couple of months into the new administration, of course, in Washington. Very excited to have you into the Buzz House, Tom.
Thank you.
I'm going to turn it over to Garrick to jump right into our discussion with Tom. Go ahead, Garrick.
Yeah, thanks, Don. And Tom, thanks for being on Buzz House. And before we jump into some specific questions, would you please give our listeners some insight into your background and work now with Lincoln Avenue Communities?
Sure. Yeah, no, I appreciate the opportunity. Don hit some of the high notes, but thank you for let me join you today as well. So I've been in the affordable housing industry for a little more than 20 years. For the past three of them with Lincoln Avenue Communities, where really my focus has been anything touching state and federal advocacy, as well as corporate strategy around building resiliency, sustainability, and resident impact. Prior to joining Lincoln, I spent 17 years in successive roles at the National Housing and Rehabilitation Association, where I first got to know Don, which is a national trade group focused on affordable housing development and finance. And I'll also just share, I have a little side gig as well. I also serve as executive director of Fairview Housing Partners, which is a 501c3 affordable housing intermediary, as well as an emerging CDFI.
Awesome. Thanks for that introduction. I know there's a lot to get to, right? But I think at the top of the mind of a lot of our listeners right now is the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act, which was actually reintroduced into the House on April 8th. Would you be able to remind our listeners of some of those key provisions in that act and what path it needs to take to get into any sort of tax policy legislation that people can hang their hat on?
Yeah, so the AHCIA is really our hallmark legislation around the low-income housing tax credit. It got introduced in the House, as you mentioned, with great fanfare, over 100 original co-sponsors. It is a very bipartisan bill. We're certainly looking to expand that co-sponsorship and support. We're expecting it to be reintroduced in the Senate most likely next week, and we hope with similar levels of support. There's a lot of great provisions in the AHCIA. For me, some key highlights, lowering the 50% test to 25%. This change alone, we estimate, would increase affordable housing production above its current production by more than a million units over 10 years. So it would be my expectation in a lot of states that are volume cap constrained that we would closely double production in a lot of those states just from this provision alone. It would also restore the 12.5% increase and the 9% cap, which we had for 4 years and expired a couple of years ago, and would take it a step further and actually expand the amount of allocation for 9% credits by 50% over 2 years. So those are the two big provisions, but there's a lot of other great things in there that we'd love to see passed as well. It would, for example, repeal the qualified census tract population cap, which would basically make all census tracts that meet the other QCT standards eligible, so making that basis boost available to a lot more places. Similarly, it would do something, a corollary type of change for the DDA population cap. It wouldn't lift it entirely, but it would increase it from 20 to 30%. There's a number of provisions that would expand basis boosts for other types of high impact projects, 50% basis boost for ELI units, as well as the discretionary basis boost for bond deals, defining DDA or defining certain rural areas and certain districts within Indian country as DDAs as well. A lot of things that would help with financial feasibility. In terms of the path forward, listen, Congress doesn't pass standalone tax bills, so we'd be looking for a vehicle. The likeliest vehicle in the short term would be the tax reconciliation legislation that the House and Senate are working on right now. Obviously, we would love to see all of the AHCIA included in there, but realistically, I think that we are going to be advocating for the highest impact pieces that are most likely to pass, and hopefully we'll get a few of those things done.
Tom, just one actually real quick question on that to your last point, because you see maybe the 50% tax reduction to 25% gets passed, but not the 50% increase in 9%. So could even the AHCIA as it is be carved up perhaps?
I think that that's honestly the most likely scenario. I think we feel relatively, I don't know if confident is the right word, but optimistic anyway, that the 50% test reduction and the 12.5% increase in 9% stands a fairly good chance. That's largely because of the strong support for the credit in the House and Senate already, but also recognizing that those provisions were included in the Smith-Wyden bill that passed the House overwhelmingly in the 118th Congress. So it didn't make it to the finish line in the Senate, but we already know that there's strong support in a tax bill for those provisions. And those are the ones that we have the highest level of confidence as being in the mix. But we hope that we'll be able to pick off a couple of other things. Now, you know, there are certain things in the AHCIA, honestly, that would not be eligible in a reconciliation bill. There are arcane rules in the tax reconciliation and budget process. And without going into too much detail, basically anything that doesn't have a cost can't be included in a budget reconciliation bill. So I didn't mention some of the provisions around reporting and streamlining and the student rule and things that don't have an economic impact, but those would, by the rules of the Senate, the Byrd rule or the Byrd-Bath, as it's called, would not be eligible for inclusion, even if there was universal support for them. So it's unfortunate that the things that have like no cost, but would just make the program work better, are not going to be able to ride on that train.
Sure. That's a great point, Tom. Tom, keeping on the general topic of tax and tax policy, are there any early discussions around other provisions in the tax code which could have impact on the light tech industry? A lot of people are always asking, will there be corporate tax rate changes? Bonus depreciation has been phasing out. Is that coming back? Or any other topics that are on the table?
Yeah, I mean, we could probably spend the rest of the podcast talking about just that alone. But yeah, in addition to what we discussed already, I think bonus depreciation is definitely something in the mix right now for expansion. It was in the original Trump TCJIA bill. It's obviously really important for us and in particular for our investors. It increases their yield and gets us a little bit better pricing. So we certainly hope that that will be included. And I know there's a lot of strong advocates beyond our industry that are pushing for bonus depreciation. Other things that seem to be in the mix, some positive, some negative. So CSALT or corporate state and local taxes are actually something that there's been a fair amount of conversation in meetings I'm having with Ways and Means folks over the last little while. It was not part of the original bill, but it is a potential pay for. And obviously the ability to deduct state and local taxes, particularly in states that don't have an as-of-right tax exemption for affordable housing or pilots, that could have an operational impact on our business in the long term if that gets included in the mix. 199A is another thing that we should all be keeping an eye on. This is the 20% deduction for qualified business income for pass-through entities, many of which are owners and of commercial real estate generally and tax credits specifically. So that's something that we want to watch and would be expiring if the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act provisions aren't extended. A lot of talk about the IRA tax provisions as well. That's obviously a loaded topic, but we have a lot of concerns around what happens to the solar tax credit. We like to use it a lot in our affordable housing transactions. It's been a really great part of the capital stack and really benefits our residents, frankly, reducing their utility spend and making that part of their living expenses more predictable. Will the solar credit be reduced? If so, under what sort of phase out? Will the basis provisions, which allow us to not reduce our LIHTC basis by the solar basis, continue on? That's really important. The same thing goes with the expansion of 179D in the IRA. How will that be phased out as well? Corporate rates, I'm actually not hearing a whole lot about corporate rates right now. Certainly, President Trump in the campaign had talked about reducing corporate rates. But I don't know that that's a huge part of the discussion from what we're hearing on the Hill. But obviously, any reduction in corporate rates would have an impact on yield and demand for tax credits as well. And likewise, if corporate rates were to increase for some reason, that could have impact in the opposite direction. Opportunity zones, I would fully expect to see some activity there in the tax bill, likely at a minimum, an expansion of the incentive, opportunity to create new opportunity zones, probably change the reporting requirements. We'd love to see some tweaks on the incentive as well. So there are a lot of things that could be done to make the opportunity zone incentive work better in the affordable housing context. So one thing might be changing the substantial improvement test to make rehab projects that are located in opportunity zones benefit. Another thing that I know there's a lot of conversation around is allowing cash to be invested in opportunity zones as opposed to capital gains. And maybe you don't get the full benefit of the incentive, but a lot of our investors, our tax credit investors, don't have capital gains or don't have timely capital gains, if you will, and allowing them to use other sources of funding and perhaps get the long-term benefits there may make the pool of investors bigger and create more competition, which would be great as well. What happens to carried interest is another thing that we should be thinking about on the back end of all of our transactions. And certainly President Trump has been very vocal about that recently, about eliminating or curtailing carried interest, and that has an effect. What we haven't really seen a whole lot of details on yet, but I expect will be coming pretty soon, are the pay-fors as well. So depending on where each house lands in terms of how much they want to cut, and you know that's a big unresolved issue as of yet, they're going to need to figure out how to pay for not just the extension of the 2017 provisions, but ideally the provisions that the president wants to add and that we as advocates want to add. So obviously we want to see an expansion of the LIHTC, but there's constituencies that want to see personal SALT limits changed, and there's tax on tips and things of that nature. They all need to get paid for in some way. And depending on how much they need to cut to get to a compromise, that could have an effect on funding for other programs that are really important for affordable housing. So if they decide that the best way to extend the Trump tax cuts are to cut areas in other parts of the budget to get to the finish line, what does that mean for Section 8 or for home or CDBG or other incentives and tools that we use? So we could go on and on, but those are at least a few ideas to kick around.
Yeah, Tom, a lot of really good information. Very interesting on the opportunity zone and how it can be more effective in helping out our LIHTC industry. Thanks for those comments. Tom, switching gears, CRA, Community Reinvestment Act, was in the news again, of course, recently with the federal bank regulatory agencies announcing their intent to rescind the 2023 Community Reinvestment Act final rule. Should we be, does this concern us? Anything we should be thinking about? How does this affect the LIHTC industry, do you think?
Yeah, I think that we have to think about it in the short term and the long term. So on the short term, the rescission of the Biden era rule doesn't come as much of a surprise to any of us, in addition to the president really emphasizing wanting to revisit a lot of the regulations that the Biden administration put out. There was also the lawsuit, and so it's been on hold for a little while anyway. So where it resets to are the old CRA rules, which basically have been hanging around there for 20 years. And I think that that's, in the short term, a positive. It's something that we're all very familiar with, and our investor partners and lending partners are all very familiar with. There were aspects of that rule that I think many of us know and love, like the investment test that was actually missing in the most recent rule. So there's certainly an opportunity as it gets revisited and updated in the medium term to hopefully make some positive changes that will work better with affordable housing. That being said, knowing where the Trump administration is likely to start their draft regs, they haven't talked a whole lot about what they want to see in this current iteration, but we can refer back to the OCC draft CRA regs that were presented at the end of the first Trump administration. And I would say on the whole, the industry and investors had a lot of concern about that reg that came out. And even the fact that it came out separate from the Fed and the OCC and the FDIC, I think is concerning. You know, having three different sets of regs potentially just complicates things for our syndicator partners and bank partners. Now, my understanding is that it is the intention moving forward to have a coordinated set of CRA regs again in the Trump administration. So that's probably less of a concern, but we're going to, I guess, just have to wait and see. But I think at least for the next year or two, we're going to have at least predictability and stability in CRA regs. And that's probably a good thing when there's so many other things that are uncertain right now.
Isn't that the truth? So, Tom, I do have a question about GSEs, right? Because there seems to be a lot of continued sort of attention around them. So what is new on this front and how may that impact the LIHTC industry?
Well, a lot of activity right now at the GSEs. So first and foremost, there's a new Federal Housing Finance Agency director, Bill Pulte, who comes from the housing industry, a scion of the Pulte Homes home builders. Since he was confirmed in the Senate, there's been a lot of activity, so mainly in the form of leadership changes. So Chairman Pulte or Director Pulte is now the chairman of both boards of directors for both GSEs, which is certainly a step away from precedent. A lot of the other directors that have been there over the last few years are no longer there, and there's some senior leadership changes across both of the GSEs as well. So with change, I guess we all have to really wait and see how those changes play out to a certain extent. But certainly there is a change at the, you know, in the big chairs in those organizations. Now, I think what happens in the long term to the GSEs is interesting. So there have been, I mean, I guess, you know, the GSEs have been in conservatorship since 2008. So I think a lot of folks think that that is way too long and that the GSEs continue to play a really critical part of the housing finance system. So we obviously want to stay on top of that. I think Director Pulte, as well as both the HUD and Treasury secretaries, have recently made statements about wanting to get the GSEs out of conservatorship, maybe not in the very short term, but certainly during this term. So I think that a lot of things have to happen, though, for that to actually occur. First and foremost, there does seem to be consensus that whatever approach that the Trump administration may pursue here, they don't want to do any harm to the 30-year mortgage in the housing finance system, which is obviously a big sigh of relief for everybody. I don't know why anybody would want to do harm to the housing finance system anyway, but they're going to take a measured approach. There are a lot of things that have to happen along the way to get there, though. And first and foremost, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac both have to increase their capital positions. And from what I understand, they're maybe halfway to where they need to be in terms of retained capital to even consider leaving conservatorship. And there are potential implications there for the affordable housing industry to get the other half of the way there. So if they have to go out and raise capital, well, you have to think about where is that capital going to come from? Presumably, some of that's going to be the sale of stocks or the sale of the treasury warrants, but they may also, and I'll just say that this is, I don't want to say speculation, but nobody's said that this is going to happen. But you think about where some of the profits from the GSEs go. Some of it goes to retained earnings and some of it goes to programs that we know and love, like the National Housing Trust Fund or Capital Magnet Funds. Those are both funded out of the profits of the GSEs. So presumably, one potential way to raise additional capital would be to reduce allocations for those programs, which would have implications for affordable housing. Likewise, the GSEs invest substantial dollars each year in the low-income housing tax credit as investors, and that is at the discretion of the FHFA director. They set goals for the GSEs, and you could see that changing. Certainly, we'd love to see the GSEs invest more dollars in the low-income housing tax credit, but you could also see a case being made to reduce LIHTC investments to shore up the capital position. So again, I haven't heard Director Pulte or anybody in Treasury or HUD saying that that's the plan, but those are things that I'd be certainly watching out for. The next thing that really has to happen, or maybe it's concurrently needs to happen, is articulating a strategy around the GSE's guarantor structure. and what the federal government's role is going to be in that. That's the full faith and credit of the federal government behind the GSE guarantees. That's critical to the housing finance system, the ability to securitize mortgages, whether they're multifamily or single family. And that's been a real sticking point historically in a lot of the different strategies that had been presented previously on reprivatizing the GSEs. So we'll, I guess, have to see how that looks, how those guarantees may be paid for. One novel idea that I'm not sure how much traction this is really getting, but the Treasury Secretary has been talking about this a little bit in the press, is potentially putting the Treasury's interests in the GSEs, so their warrants that they hold, into a newly created or to be created U.S. sovereign wealth fund. And if that were to be the case, the U.S. sovereign wealth fund would be a substantial owner of the GSEs, but there could be other stockholders as well. And maybe that's a way to get the market acceptance of the full faith and credit of the U.S. government behind the GSEs without necessarily having the articulated guarantor program and guarantee fees. So I'm looking forward to learning more about how or if that approach is being taken, but it is a novel and new approach that I don't think has been discussed previously until relatively recently.
Very good. Great insight, Tom. That was very interesting to listen to. Next discussion point, moving to maybe somewhat of a broader topic, and we communicated a little bit before this about deregulation, right, which is a big thing. How do you see, Tom, the administration's emphasis on quote-unquote deregulation impacting the affordable housing space?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this quite a bit. Now, I'm a believer in a defined appropriate role for government in the oversight of its program. So I'm not of the opinion that there should be no regulation, but I think anybody that has ever kind of worked in this space has experienced some level of frustration in federal regs. Maybe they haven't evolved with the time, some that seem duplicative or unnecessary or burdensome, particularly as conditions for affordable housing get more and more challenging. So I see the rhetoric around deregulation and frankly, some of the ideas that are being shared and emphasized right now to be a potential real positive for change for our industry. Certainly the administration's been very vocal and seems to recognize that, you know, a more efficient regulatory structure can produce more housing by reducing the overall cost and spreading those scarce dollars further. And I think there are a lot of things that we're actively engaging with both Congress and the Trump administration that seem to be getting at least some interest. I don't know about traction yet, but the biggest one, and I think probably the most likely thing to happen in the short term, is some review, perhaps suspension of NEPA. And there's actually an executive order out on this already, which is why I think it's the most likely thing to be pursued. But they've been pretty vocal that a lot of times the requirements around the National Environmental Protection Act do not sort of align with reality on the ground. I think about affordable housing rehab projects, for example, that, you know, have previously undergone NEPA reviews in their original iterations. Is it really necessary to do a full NEPA review again? But new construction as well. There's a lot of different parties that are reviewing environmental aspects of projects locally and at the state level. And is an additional federal layer really necessary? I think if you look at the history of NEPA, it was really designed for something very different than what we do in the industry. It's came out of, you know, federal highway projects and the building of dams and things that really could have a very significant environmental impact at scale. Whereas an infill development in an urban neighborhood probably should be treated differently. And I think we have a great opportunity to kind of right size those requirements and perhaps eliminate, in some cases, totally or at least a duplicative requirements to make deals financially more feasible and close faster. Because it can easily add half a year to a full year to your development pipeline just navigating NEPA-related issues. Davis-Bacon reform, I think, is another area where I think there's a ripe opportunity for change. At a minimum, some of the basic definitions that were adopted in the 1970s around what is a residential building. So if it's more than four stories, It's not residential anymore. That was born out of the building codes of the 1970s and what you could build back then. Whereas now you can build stick frame construction if you're in a mass timber environment up to 20 stories. If we could update those definitions, how the wage scales are collected and having uniform wage scales, there are lots of efficiency opportunities around Davis-Bacon to make it more predictable, increase competition in the GC and subspace, and potentially reduce costs. You can see at least a little bit in action now. I think just last week, the home rule that was put out in the Biden administration was repealed, and Congress is actively doing an RFI, which I'm actually working on right now when we're done on this podcast. I'm getting back to my response to that, trying to identify ways to streamline and improve both the home program and the CDBG program. And I think that there are some obvious areas for improvement there to make them both less burdensome and just work a little bit better. If you've ever worked in the world of multiple affordable housing programs, you'll be frustrated, no doubt, by the opportunity to have multiple inspections and multiple income certification requirements from multiple agencies, which I think even just some guidance saying one will take precedence over the other, or better guidance in that regard, could be really helpful. Another area that we'd love to see some additional focus on is the definitions and methodologies around determining area median income, which of course is what we use to determine who's eligible to live in our properties and what their rents are. The current formulas include ceilings and caps that effectively act as rent control in the affordable housing space. And we know from every economist and any number of studies and reports that when rent control is in place, it reduces housing production, which is not what we need right now. So those are certainly some opportunities around deregulation. I think there's a fair amount that the administration could do on its own, particularly if they take a more aggressive legal interpretation. And there's certainly a role for Congress right now, which at least in the House Financial Services Committee so far, they seem to be pursuing to make some of our current programs work better.
Very good. A lot on that, Tom. A lot to follow for all of our listeners as well. Thank you for that. Tom, one other topic we wanted to bounce past to you is, I know it's an area you spent some time in, is insurance. We know there were some hearings around this in the last year or so, and tip of everyone's tongue, what kind of insights can you share just around the insurance topic?
Yeah, I think that affordable housing owners and multifamily owners generally have been just really frustrated over the last, call it 3 or 4 years, about the insurance environment. It's been one of the thorniest challenges we've faced as an industry. I think if you look back probably, again, 4 or 5 years, property rates are probably up on average more than 100%, in some cases 2 or even 500%. And casualty rates have been accelerating at a pretty significant clip over that same period as well, particularly in the last 12 months. And there's a direct impact on housing affordability when you have insurance rates increase, particularly at those rates. To really kind of simplify it, when our operating expenses go up and insurance rates are, or the insurance spend is probably the fastest growing operating expense that owners have had to, what's the word I'm looking for, absorb over the last couple of years. In conventional markets, it drives up rents, just plain and simple. You pass those on through to your residents. In affordable housing, where we are both rent and income restricted, we're not really able to do so, which puts us under some pressure. On the housing finance side of the equation, again, when your operating expenses grow up, it directly reduces your leverage. And when other costs are going up and interest rates are going up at the same time, that can be the straw that breaks the camel's back when it comes to the capital stack. I think about this a lot because, as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, one of the things that I oversee as part of our portfolio is our resident service strategy. If we're not able to raise rents, there's really not a whole lot that we can do other than potentially cut back services, which we don't want to do, or potentially reduce or defer maintenance, which I think, if anything, makes it more likely that there will be a claims event in the future that will increase our rates over time. So it's both not economic and also not fair to our residents that deserve to live in a high quality affordable housing. So I guess that's a little bit of the context on why it's important. Well, so what do we do about it, I guess, is the bigger issue. On the positive side, I will say property markets appear to be stabilizing a little bit right now, which is to say that rates aren't really going down, or if they are going down, it's going down a little bit. So we're not getting back to 5 years ago, but we're one major event away, or a property or a portfolio is one major claim away from pushing that dynamic back. Congress is definitely taking notice. As you mentioned, we had a couple of hearings in both the House and the Senate last year, a couple of interesting bills introduced in both chambers as well. Most recently, in the 119th Congress, actually, Senator Adam Schiff and Senator Tim Sheehy have introduced a fire insurance bill, which we think has a lot of potential, particularly right now for homeowners, but we hope we'll see expanded to multifamily owners. The solutions that I think we need and that there's growing consensus around really flow from a couple of dynamics. Fundamentally, if you think about the insurance industry and how it works, it's not that complicated, right? You collect premiums, you take those premiums and you invest them in some sort of yielding investment, and you pay out claims. And so long as premiums and investment income exceed claims, then you've got a business. What we've experienced during the hard markets is that dynamic not working out. So you think about what those inputs are and how we can affect it. First thing we need to do is reduce claims. And I think there's a lot that we can do as owners to do so, and there's a lot that policymakers can do as well. So we would love to see more incentives, tax incentives, grants, et cetera, around hardening assets against natural disasters. There was a great bill in the 118th Congress sponsored by Representatives Mike Thompson and Richie LaMalfa that would do just that. And we hope we'll see that reintroduced in the 119th. From an operations and maintenance perspective, I think our asset management and property management teams really need to be focused on loss mitigation practices. So that can include emergency preparedness. That can include strategic investments in things like leak detection and fire stops and the like that are actually generating a lot of claims. Claims management, frankly, is a really important piece of it. Tort reform is another different type of solution, but as we see claims on our liability policies increase and we see larger and larger settlements and jury awards, that's really driving the market there. And potentially at the state or federal level, policies that can be implemented to cap liabilities or transfer presumption of liability could be effective in moderating that. The other side of the equation, and thinking about the goal, which is that we have consistent, available, attainable insurance when times are good, but also when times are bad, this is where we probably need some solution around a backstop, essentially. So when capital is constrained in the insurance markets, because insurance companies, historically, some of them have gone out of business or have chosen to leave high claim markets, where you have lack of competition, that's when rates really skyrocket. So ensuring that there is sufficient capital by having some sort of backstop or guarantee or risk share would be the other half of the equation that will help us in the long term.
Very good. Again, a lot of great insights, Tom. Really appreciate it. And a great discussion overall. A lot of insights, and our listeners will really appreciate this level of detail. Just one additional question as we wrap up, Tom, and that's around advocacy. I know you've long been around advocacy your entire career. Any special considerations where we are in this point where things are introduced into the House and the Senate or just in general? Any tips for advocacy for our affordable housing industry and our listeners?
Yeah, so there are a lot of things to rally around right now. And I think advocating on behalf of the AHCIA makes a lot of sense, both ideally in seeing the bill enacted and whole, but as a placeholder for affordable housing and tax reform. So there's every reason to be doing advocacy around the tax credit right now. If we do not represent our interests and our industry sufficiently, there is a risk that we could get left on the cutting room floor. Fortunately, it's really easy to be an advocate for affordable housing. We've got a great product to sell, right? Everybody has wonderful stories they can tell about their work. And it's really our job as industry participants to do that. And I think a lot of people think, well, you know, my congressman's in the wrong party or is not on the right committee. There's really not a whole lot I can do. And I would just encourage everybody to think more broadly about what makes a constituent. So certainly where you live and where you vote matters, but where your office matters also, if that's not where you live, where your properties are, rallying your vendors and partners that work in your properties and getting them on message and making those phone calls and emails and setting up those meetings. Those ribbon cuttings and groundbreakings are really important in making, establishing not just constituency, but establishing impact. And we owe it to our businesses, but more importantly, to our residents and our potential residents that, but for the lack of affordable housing, would be living in our communities to be representing them and their needs. And there's no shortage of resources to tell that story. All you have to do is go to the Action Campaign's website or the Tax Credit Coalition's website to get all the fact sheets and talking points that you need, or call up peers in the industry like me if you're looking for advice. I think there's never been a more important time to really tell our story. And it's an easy story to tell. It's a bipartisan issue. We're creating jobs. We're creating housing. I often joke, but it's not really a joke, that you tell me your problem and I'll tell you how affordable housing can solve it, whether it's healthcare or poverty or job creation. I mean, we check all of those boxes. And so really the most important thing going into these meetings is just being prepared and understanding who you're talking to and what their priorities are, and then tailoring your message to resonate. And it's easy to do and it's satisfying. You don't have to go to Washington to do it, although it's fun to walk the halls of Congress. You can set up those meetings in the district. And if not now, when?
Perfect. I love that. If not now, when? It's a great way to end our discussion. Tom, thank you very much for joining us today. That's it for the episode of The Buzz House. Catching up with Tom Emder of Lincoln Avenue Communities, discussing housing and tax policy and what to expect in 2025. Thanks again, Tom, very much for joining us.
Thanks, Don. Thanks, Garrett. Appreciate it.
Once again, I'm Don Bernards.
And I'm Garrett Gibson. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. For additional resources around multifamily housing, check out BakerTilly.com. If you have a suggestion for the show, email us at buildabakertilly.com. That's BUILD@BakerTilly.com. See you next time on Buzz House.